So today is Martin Luther King Day, and I was wondering what I could talk about today. I was very happy that last year when we had Martin Luther King Day, Ellen Sinocchi came and gave a talk, mostly reading, I think, speeches from Martin Luther King. And I thought perhaps of saying something about Martin Luther King's teachings on nonviolence. I think it's quite fascinating, quite marvelous that one of the secular saints of the United States, in that we have a holiday after him, is one of the great champions of and 20th century champions of nonviolence. And it's nice that America has someone like that as a cultural saint, cultural hero, cultural role model for the power and the value of nonviolence. And I've given talks about Buddhist teachings on nonviolence in the past, and somehow it didn't quite sit with me that I'd talk about that. But what I decided to do is not quite directly related to Martin Luther King, but is to talk about fear. And that was a little bit more up for me as a topic. And there definitely seemed a connection, because the kind of work that Martin Luther King did and the kind of thing that he was an advocate for, I think requires coming to terms with fear, or somehow not being limited by fear. And one of my first interests in Buddhism was when I was in college, where I was a pacifist in a time when people like men like my age were being drafted for Vietnam. And so there's a lot of active discussions in the dorm, college dorms, about war and violence and nonviolence and civil disobedience and nonviolent action. And in being a pacifist in these very kind of tense times and very active conversations we used to have, it became very clear to me that if I was going to follow through my ideals of pacifism, I would have to be willing to put my life on the line. For example, doing some act of civil disobedience. And I was very acutely aware of how afraid I was of doing that. So, and I felt bad about my inability to live my ideals because of my fear. And that was one of my first doors to Buddhism then, was I thought, oh, I was looking for some way to deal with that fear, to come to terms with it so it wouldn't limit me from living the life that I wanted to live. And somehow I settled on Buddhism as offering the tools, the skills, the practices that would help me come to terms with that fear. I haven't tested it in that kind of extreme way, so I don't know how well Buddhism has done for me since in that quest, that ideal. I would like to think that I'm less afraid than I was some 30 years ago. I do remember also, some almost 30 years ago, reading a study. I don't know how good a study it was, but the study was correlating people's different kind of people, different religious affiliations, different life experience kind of people had, to see people's relative fear of death. And among the people who had the least fear of death were people who meditated a lot. It didn't specify what kind of meditation. But I thought that was very interesting, that meditation somehow has an impact on our fear and something as deep and in us as the fear of death. So fear, as we know, is a very popular emotion. And it seems to be relatively pervasive. I've come across a couple of people in my life who seem to be without fear. And one of them seemed to have a lot of conceit with that. So I don't know if, where the balance was, or what's gooder. And others seemingly born that way. I don't know why some people are that way. Most people are not. Some people, of course, have a lot more fear than others. And there's many causes and conditions for that. In about 7 years ago, Dharma Seed Tape Library, which is the nonprofit organization that gathers together all the Dharma tapes of all the Vipassana teachers in America and then distributes themselves. Now they're all available for free in exchange for a donation. They sent me the list of their top 10 selling tapes for that year. in 1995 or something. And one of the surprises for me was to see that of those top 10 best-selling tapes, four of them had to do with fear. And it's, you know, a very important issue for people. And then in thinking about fear, I certainly felt reassured a little bit that this was a good topic, since I thought chances are that 90% of you, at least, have some to deal with fear in some way or other. And so it's something that's common to all of us, most of us. But in thinking about it, I also was thinking about how complex it is. There's so many different kinds of fear and so many different things we're afraid of, and so many different ways of understanding fear. It's like, I think you could write a dictionary, you know, with all kinds of different kinds of fear and words for fear. We have, you know, worry. I don't know, maybe there's even lighter words than worry, but worry and maybe concern. I'm concerned, we say, on the light end of what being afraid. And then there's worry, and then there's fear, and there's anxiety, and there's terror and panic, and there's probably other good words too in the fear camp. It may be a surprise to some of you, that in Buddhism, fear by itself is not considered, in and of itself, is not judged or categorized as an unhelpful emotion, as an unwholesome emotion. Whereas I think many times in the West, the kind of automatic assumption is, oh, fear is wrong or bad in some way. I shouldn't be afraid. And there's a helpful fear in Buddhism and an unhelpful fear. The most common helpful fear is called the fear of doing wrong, fear of moral transgression, fear of doing something that will cause us to feel somehow, you know, like we violated our own integrity. So, like you go up against the edge of maybe wanting, you know, doing some transgression, hurting someone through our speech or stealing or hitting someone or something, and you see, oh, and there's a kind of recoiling from that, the kind of fear. Oh, the consequences of that are not only bad for the other people but bad for myself, and just kind of a healthy kind of fear that's connected to conscience, the fear of conscience. And in Buddhism, this kind of conscience is called the guardian of the world. It's considered very important, what prevents people from doing all kinds of horrible things to each other. The unhelpful fear is what many of us are most familiar with. And unhelpful fear is often, in modern psychological terms, connected with imagination. We imagine something that's going to happen in the future, when there's actually no fear, nothing to be afraid of actually in the present. If some of you are sitting here in this room afraid of mountain lions coming into this hall, you have a very active imagination. And it's your imagination which is producing that fear. And so a psychotherapist will point out that a lot of the anxiety that people feel, some psychotherapists will say that anxiety in itself involves our imagination, a projection into the future of what might happen. And some people have stronger imaginations about that than others. But a tremendous amount of difficulty arises for people from how they use their imagination. Imagination being a great tool that opens a lot of wonderful doors for us, but also closes others, especially with the help of fear. And there are many things to be afraid of. There's a fear of pain, of separation, of loss, of rejection, of failure, of solitude, of death, of strangers, of walking alone at night, of going to the cities, going into the suburbs, going into the countryside, fear of illness, food, fear of food, different kinds of foods, fear of others in all kinds of ways, fear of heights, fear of ourselves, fear of fear. I read once that some person defined anxiety as the fear of fear. I don't know if that works, but that was an interesting idea, at least. The fear of fear, for some people, is quite debilitating. Then there's also a kind of fear that fear concerning other people. Parents have the fear of their children, or children have fear for their parents, wanting their parents' well-being, especially as the parents get older, perhaps. When my son was younger, I don't forget, 2.5 or something, 3, he seemed to have be a little bit tuned into death earlier than most young children. And at some point, he was concerned that his parents were going to die before him, you know, before him or something, you know. And that was a fear of his, fear for your parents. I guess fear of loss there. Fear for our friends, our family. Fear of our country. Fear of the state of the world. There's a lot of things to be afraid of in the world we live in. And people carry a lot of fear. There are people I know now who will turn on the radio to listen to the news to find out if there's been some terrorist attack. There's this kind of thing that's carrying this anxiety with them. And they will find out to make sure nothing's happened. Any of you do that? I've talked to people who've done that, do that. Open the newspaper with some trepidation in a way that maybe you didn't do 2 years ago. So what are the benefits and what are the costs? What are the harms of being afraid? And are there times when it's useful to be afraid and are there times when it gets in our way? And it's pretty easy to think of situations where fear might be useful. And the kind of things people will say is, oh, and it's good to be afraid of, you know, a big truck coming barreling down at you when you're in the middle of the street crossing the road. Or a good thing to be afraid of mountain lions when the mountain lion's actually there. Or good things to be afraid of heights, you know, if you're standing with your toes over the edge of Half Dome. Though I've also heard that maybe that kind of fear is overrated, because in a situation of great danger, where there's actually real danger, some people report that they're not afraid at that time. They seem to know what to do. Something clicks and they somehow do the right thing. And afterwards, they're afraid. So the justification that fear is useful because it keeps us kind of on our toes, it keeps things, maybe that's good. But I think we need to look at it a little bit lightly because of the often when there is real danger, the system seems to click in a way. And maybe what's required is not constant fear, but constant mindfulness. Be more mindful and vigilant. Be aware, present. In the teachings of the Buddha, mindfulness is considered to be a protecting force. One of the functions of mindfulness is to guard us, guard the person who's mindful. What are the costs of fear? What are the problems of fear? And probably all of you can feel in your own body, in your shoulders, your stomach, and your stress levels, the cost that fear has. But, fear certainly can be inhibiting. We can hold back. And in that form, it can be a lost freedom. You know, we are free to some degree to act or to speak in certain ways, but we're afraid to. And so we don't even exercise our freedom. It can cost lost relationships. We don't even build relationships because we're afraid of being in relationships. It can cost us love. I've known people who've been afraid to love because of the pain that's potentially possible in the disappointment of love that can happen. In various ways, people become closed. They shut down because they're afraid. They get stuck. Chronic fear creates a tremendous amount of stress on the whole system, but also predisposes us to be more afraid, to be afraid again, to walk around being afraid. And one of the interesting things that happens with people when they meditate a lot, especially like if you go on retreat, is we begin tracking our mental processes, seeing much more clearly what's going on. And we're not being so distracted by entertainment, by friends, all the things we have to do, and all kinds of things. And you just really see what's going on in your own mind. And some people then become really surprised at how pervasive their fear is. People have come to me and said, I had no idea how pervasive my fear was. I'm always afraid. It's a very subtle level, but it's always there operating, always there kind of vigilant and concerned and worried about something. And not always sure what I'm worried about. I'm just worried. You know, it's kind of always there kind of hovering in the background. chronic fear. Oh, another benefit of fear, which is almost arises together with unhelpful fear. Almost anything which is unhelpful in Buddhism can become helpful if you know how to pay attention to it. Isn't that great? That's why sometimes they talk about using everything as, you know, as compost. You can compost anything. And but fear is like on a retreat, for example. You know, you're probably one of the safest places you're ever going to be, sitting on some of these Buddhist retreats. And people come there and have talked about how safe it is. You know, they leave their wallet, you know, on the ground, and it's there when you come back, or someone collects it. And you know, people don't lock their doors. And I've had people come tell me and say, "This is the first time I've ever been in an environment where I felt so safe, where I didn't have to feel like I had to lock my door before I came and left, and any time." And it's a relatively safe environment, though Spirit Rock does have mountain lions. And people have seen them out there. And it's one of the environments where I've seen people terrified. People have come, you know, to the teachers, you know, asking for help because, you know, they're completely pale and sweating and having panic attacks or completely petrified. And, you know, it's a safe environment. And the fear arises in this safe environment. Why is fear there? The strength of the fear that we have, the strength of the fear we have that comes from imagination, of imagining things, or anxiety, the greater the strength of the fear, the greater the opportunity is to go into the fear and understand some very deep attachment or holding pattern, some very deep aspect of who we are that needs to be transformed, that can be transformed. It's almost like fear is showing us our growing edge. And so one of the benefits of tuning into your fear is to see, oh, this is my growing edge. This is where I should tune into and pay attention. So then the question is, how do we practice with fear? How do we tune into it? How do we compost our fear? How do we bring it in? Where's the compost bin? What do we do with it? And I think the first thing is a willingness to be present for it. That's like 90% of it. And fear is often something we're not willing to be present for. There's kind of a running away from fear. Fear itself is a message sometimes to run away or close down or shut down. But to be willing to be present for it, to be willing to stop for it, to see it, not to turn away from it. And it's said in the suttas that before the Buddha was enlightened, he made a vow that if fear arose in his practice, he would continue doing whatever he was doing until he saw through the fear. So if he was doing sitting meditation, he would just sit until the fear somehow passed. If he was doing walking meditation, he would walk until fear passed. So somehow he'd just kind of be with it, look at it, stay with it, with the fear. So willingness to see it as a subject worthy of attention and investigation. And this is counterintuitive, I think, to many of us. It's counterintuitive to go towards the pain, to go towards the fear, and actually look at it much more clearly and deeply. And what we learn is that often enough, focusing and observing fear will disarm it. And the greater skills you have in learning to focus and observe, to be observer in what's going on, the greater the disarming effect the practice will have on your fear. One of the things that I found very helpful with fear, which is a classic Vipassana thing to do, is in observing it, is to name it. And sometimes when I'm afraid, like I'm sitting in a conversation with someone, and for some reason I'm starting to feel a little bit anxious or afraid in the conversation for some reason or other, I can be aware of it. I know it's there. But if I, in my mind, name it, oh, this is fear. Here it is, fear. There's that naming of it actually becomes a more fully embodied or more fully acknowledgement of it. It's like truth stating, stating what it is makes it much more, disarms it, or kind of I see it more clearly then, or I hold it, or I feel it more. You know, it's like, oh, there it is. So naming it, just fear or anxiety, naming it when it's there, naming it a few times. Oh, here it is, fear, anxiety. Once fear has been acknowledged, once we stop and look at it and be willing to look at it, Then there's a number of different approaches a person can do around the fear, different strategies a person might have. One of them might be to realize that maybe it's not helpful to pay attention to your fear anymore. Sometimes fear, it gets into a loop that creates panic attacks. And if you feel yourself kind of going into one of these loops, then perhaps the wise thing is not to pay attention to the fear anymore, but to do something that breaks the trance, that breaks the cycle. But, if you really have learned to stop and pay attention to the fear enough so you can see that, then perhaps you can have a wise relationship to it. Another wise thing you can do around fear is simply continue being aware of it. There doesn't have to be any further strategies of trying to fix it or manipulate it or go through it. It's just simply, here it is, and I'm going to hold it in my awareness, however long it's going to be here. And remember that awareness and love are very closely connected. And so if you bring awareness to something like fear, it's like bringing awareness, maybe even with a little mantra, which says, it's okay. It's okay. Remember Joseph Goldstein once saying that, have a fearful, fearful five-year-old shows up. You don't try to say, stop being afraid or go away until you're not afraid or, I don't like you because you're afraid. That just adds, wound upon the wound. What you do is you tell the five-year-old, it's okay, it's okay. So sometimes we need to do that for ourselves, to our own fear, just to hold it very gently in awareness, maybe have this mantra, it's okay, it's okay. But it doesn't have to be even with the mantra, simply holding things with awareness and learning how to hold it without being for or against it, without trying to do something with it, without hating it, without fighting it. Because one of the things that happens is that if we fight our fear, if we hate our fear, we're actually fighting and hating part of ourselves. And generally, that's not a very useful strategy for most of us. So can we find a way not to be at war with ourselves, to have a nonviolent approach to what we see within ourselves, to see our fear? So simply hold it in awareness. Just doing that can be phenomenally healing, though it's not healing necessarily that quickly. That requires patience. The other thing that, another strategy around fear is to learn to relax around it, to find some way to relax the body, relax something. And sometimes, for example, if the stomach is tense and you're afraid, to relax the stomach or relax the shoulders or relax different parts of your body. If relaxation of the body is available, it can have a big impact on taking the sting away from the fear. Somehow when the body is tense, there's a way in which the unconscious, or I don't know if that's the right word, but the way which we become less conscious when the body is tense and holding. And we become more conscious, is my experience, as I learn to relax my body. So finding ways of relaxing the body in relationship to the fear. One of the classic ways of doing that is to breathe. Breathe deeply. Have long exhalations. In panic attacks, they teach people to breathe, don't they? But there are other ways of relaxing besides, physical relaxation. For Buddhists, for someone who has a deep kind of heartfelt connection to the Buddhist tradition, taking refuge is a form of relaxing. Kind of taking refuge in that which you can deeply trust. So you're finding that which you can really deeply trust and kind of rest there, let that kind of, then it's easier to be with a fear if you're taking refuge in something deeply that you trust. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. Taking refuge in the practice. For me, there are times when situations are very challenging and I don't know how to respond. I don't know what to do. Sometimes, even as a teacher, I'm that way. Sometimes people come on retreat, mostly on retreat, but sometimes outside, with very difficult personal circumstances. And it's not always so clear to me what to do. And it's not always so clear for me, what I could offer or what to do or how to help the situation. But I trust the practice. And so I'll try to practice the best I can in that situation, and which means being present to the situation, being present to what's going on within me and with the other person, being honest about what's going on, being mindful, hopefully being compassionate, hopefully not being in opposition to anybody or what's going on. And And over again, I find that the practice somehow finds its way in these situations. So for me, you know, then practice, taking refuge in the practice in the Buddha Dharma Sangha is helpful in situations sometimes where I might be afraid. Compassion is another form of relaxing or holding fear. You feel compassion for oneself, compassion for the situation. To meet the situation, meet ourselves, meet our suffering with, in a compassionate way. And remember the resource of compassion in the midst of fearful times. One of the ways to feel compassion is to realize the universality of fear. Many of us will take our fear so personal. It's all about me, myself, and mine. It's my fear, it's my situation. And it's not even personal sometimes, the fear. It's a universal aspect of being a human being. And if you realize the universal aspect of it, sometimes can be easier to be more compassionate, more open to it, more not be oppressed by it, not feel like it's a personal failure. Another strategy around fear, which is one that is often taught in Southeast Asia, in the Buddhist circles there, is to strengthen the mind. And the primary way of strengthening the mind is through developing a concentrated mind. So here in the West, in the Vipassana teachings in the West, there's a kind of much more of a psychoanalytic or analytical kind of approach where let's go into it and understand it really well. Let's almost kind of be like therapy, kind of going in and understanding it. But in Asia, where they don't have a very strong therapeutic, psychotherapeutic, a psychological approach to practice, there's a very strong emphasis on kind of avoiding it, in a sense, knowing it's there, of course, but then trying to develop a strong enough concentration so that you override the fear. And so there are all these wonderful stories then of monks and perhaps nuns who would go out into the forest and sit there intentionally waiting for the mountain lions to come. In fact, in Thailand, it was the tigers. And there's great stories of at least the ones who survived. They write about it and how great it was. And, you know, how they sat there and they closed their eyes and they could feel the breath of the tiger. And they said, if this is how I'm going to die, then let me die. If I'm going to die anyway, I might as well die in the Dharma. And so they would just kind of zero in on their breath and just at least be focused and try to develop that concentration. And then feel very happy with themselves when their concentration on the breath became strong enough it overrode their fear. This is a little, maybe, aside, but there's a wonderful English Theravada monk by the name of Ajahn Suchito. He's kind of like the second in most senior monk in England after Ajahn Sumedho. And some years ago, he did a pilgrimage in India. He was going to walk around India. He was going to walk in Bihar, the state of Bihar, which is where Bodhgaya, a lot of the important Buddhist sites are, where Bodhgaya is, where Buddha was enlightened. Now, that particular countryside around there is known for its banditry. So it's not the kind of place you usually want to go out at night. And it's not the kind of place you want to go out at night by yourself. But he was a Buddhist monk, and he felt that he was protected. So he had an attendant with him, a layman, and they were walking around in Bihar after night or walking by themselves. And sure enough, the local bandits showed up and confronted them, I think with long swords or something, but certainly with weapons of some sort or other. And Ajahn Suchito just stood there very calmly and apparently said or thought to himself, if this is how I'm going to die, at least, you know, this is a good way of dying, I suppose. And his attendant ran away. And then from the bushes far away, kind of felt bad about it. He's supposed to be the attendant who's helping and protecting the monk. So he ran back and got in a scuffle with these bandits for a while and then ran away again, bruised. And Ajahn Suchito, I don't know exactly how the story, what he did literally, but he, in some way or other, he got on his knees or did something and kind of put his head out and say, here, I'm ready. And these guys were so impressed by this, you know, fearlessness of this monk. And so They spared his life. But the only other thing they spared was his underrobe, which is kind of like a slip. And so everything was taken away from him besides a slip. So he had to walk into town in a slip. So the Asian way of kind of just developing a strong mind. And that shouldn't be undervalued, because I think sometimes I feel here in the West, some of us at least, or some of the messages we get, there's a lot of emphasis on relaxation, letting go of what you're holding onto. And not a lot of emphasis on developing the qualities of the mind to become stronger and stronger. And then it brings me back to Martin Luther King, where he talked about soul force, borrowing a term from Mahatma Gandhi, and where he championed the idea that you want to develop the soul force, you want to rely on it, and develop this tremendous inner strength, that your soul force, your truth, and your ability to confront the situations will be greater than the force of the other person's violence. And, you know, I think the whole civil rights movement was training a lot of people in how to become strong, developing inner strengths that changed America. And so part of Buddhist practice is not just letting go, but also developing strengths, strength of character, we can say, but strength of concentration, strength of honesty, strength of personal integrity or virtue, strength of compassion and equanimity, strength of patience. A lot of different strengths that can be developed with practice. The next kind of important strategy, which is very much in line with the mindfulness teachings, is to investigate the fear. So more than just simply hold it in awareness, but really get in there and explore it. What is this fear of mine? How does it manifest? How do I experience it? What goes on when I'm afraid? And there are many different things to investigate when you investigate a fear. I find it very helpful to investigate my fear in my body and to drop into my body with my fear and feel what's going on in my body, to feel the sense of tightness or tension or weakness or vulnerability that I might feel in my body when I'm afraid. And it's interesting to watch the different places that in my body that react to fear, maybe depending on the kind of fear it is. And it makes it more interesting. Makes it kind of, you know, well, where is it today? In the chest or the stomach or the hands or the shoulders or the face or the jaws or the lips or the eyes or the legs or, you know, it can be anywhere, right? And one of the values of experiencing fear in the body is it can actually be a lot easier for many people to be present for fear when you feel it in your body. It's like the body becomes kind of a place to ground the attention. The body is not another story. The body is not another imaginary idea of what might happen to you. The body is, you know, is much more concrete. And so to drop into the body and feel it, feel the fear in the body, can make it a lot easier to process it and to hold it, to bring presence to it. We can also investigate the thoughts around the fear. We can explore, is my imagination operating here? Is there really a mountain lion here? Or am I thinking there might be a mountain lion here next Monday? Because Gil keeps talking about it, and I'm sure this means it's not safe to come here next Monday. Or whatever. You know, kind of look, what's going on here? To really stop and really look as honestly as you can. And this also is a skill that we develop that becomes stronger over time. The skill to be able to turn the attention to look at our cognitive patterns, our beliefs, our thoughts. And it builds over time. It's kind of looking, begin investigating, exploring, what's going on here? What are my thoughts? What am I thinking? What am I believing here? What are the assumptions underlying this particular fear? Who told me? Upon what authority do I believe what I believe around this? You know, why? Why believe these things? To do a kind of cognitive exploration of this, both silently in terms of mindfulness, but also actively with reflections and thoughts and massaging it. What's going on here? One of the great skills or insights to develop with mindfulness practice is that you don't have to believe your thoughts. And I think people who are uninitiated to the world of self-reflection, often every thought is to be believed. And when you realize you don't have to believe your thoughts, you can take them or leave them as you wish. It's very empowering, very freeing. One of the ideas is to realize your thoughts are not you. If you don't identify with your thoughts, don't say, these thoughts are me, define who I am. Then you can have thoughts, various kinds of bizarre thoughts, and then you're not going to be hooked by them as much. They can just pass through and you're not going to be much problems. One of the realizations is to realize that fear itself doesn't define who you are. To not equate fear with you. So it's not my fear, but the fear. Can be very freeing sometimes. And to realize that, you know, because there's a kind of a contraction, a kind of holding around when it's my fear. Also, when we have me involved in it, then we start, we'll do this way. One of the investigations into fear, into thoughts, the ideas, the assumptions, the beliefs around it, is that often we'll discover that there's part of our fear can be related to our sense of self. Our self-image, how we want to represent ourselves in the world, how we think we need to be in the world in order to be safe, how we need to show ourselves in the world, who we need to be. We need to be kind, we need to be smart, we need to be non-revealing. You know, if I really show people who I am, people are not going to, you know, accept me. And this is what, this is where the great panic I've seen on retreats arises among some people. Is to realize that our attachment to self, our attachment to self-image, the attachment to the way in which we're trying to present ourselves to other people and to ourselves is a fiction. And that needs to be let go of. If we want to be free, it needs to be let go of. And to come up against that edge where you see the possibility of letting go of that particular clinging and not be familiar, not feel safe in that realm beyond self-definition, self-image. We orient ourselves, we organize ourselves in a relationship to others in our world through various kinds of ideas that we hold on to and cling to. And we start letting go of those clingings, then we don't have the same or any reference points anymore for, like, who am I and how am I supposed to be with people around me? And it can be very frightening until a person gets used to, gets kind of street smarts and learns to relax and learns the benefits of taking that great leap beyond self-image and self-representation, self-definition as a way that we cling to and hold on to. I remember very well for me the point where I came, in my practice, where I could really clearly see what I needed to do, what practice was asking me to do in terms of letting go to certain ways in which I was holding myself in the world and carrying myself and being in the world and talking to people in the world and not quite being able to do it because I was afraid. Oh, I can't do that. And it took quite a while to kind of riding that edge and taking little baby steps beyond and kind of testing the waters and rushing back and kind of, you know, exploring that. For me, it was very helpful to be on retreats, because what happens on retreats is there's Vipassana retreats and silent retreats. There's so little social interaction, and since so much of the sense of self is often related to how we relate to other people and comparative thinking and all that, that it was a very safe place for me to just let go, let go, let go, let go, let go of all these holdings that I had and find out how to be in a very open, unclinging way, without definition, without needing to be anything for anybody. So I think any spiritual practice that involves personal transformation will sooner or later bring a person up against the edge of fear. So you should know that. Maybe we should advertise that, you know. We have a big sign outside that says, Insight Meditation Center, in parentheses, come and be afraid. I guess no one would come then. But hopefully you have a sense of the great value of come and be afraid, the value of doing that, because come and be afraid means the possibility, the potential in our fear is to go beyond it, to learn how to go through it, to resolve it, to not have it stand in the way, either because it goes away, which it can, or because it no longer has a sting. We learn how to act in the world and act freely in spite of it without it bothering us because we're not grabbed by it. So I would challenge you in various ways here today as we end. One way is to challenge you all to stop and pay more attention to your fear. Give it more serious attention. And even the subtle fears that arise. Because what happens on retreat is that people say, oh, it was always so subtle. I didn't really notice it in daily life. But it's so pervasive and so central to how my whole personality or how I see myself in the world and how I act. If you can tune in to the subtlety of your fear. The other thing I challenge you to do is to question the assumption that fear, your fear, is helping you to keep you, helping to keep you safe. If it's not helping you to keep you safe, then you should be afraid of it. Then, you know, maybe it doesn't have, you know, much real important function. Remember, the Buddha said that mindfulness is the great protector. And then please remember compassion. Remember, have compassion for other people who are afraid. And have compassion for, as you realize, how much unhealthy behavior in the world arises from people who are afraid. How much of the violence that we see in the world arises because people are afraid. Hopefully, as we begin to be honestly face our fear, we'll understand other people at the level of their fear, maybe in ways they don't even understand. And so we can be more compassionate to the suffering of even the people who perpetuate violence in this world of ours. And certainly compassion for ourselves. The world needs people who are fearless, and the world needs people who are compassionate. And what better role model for compassion and fearlessness than Martin Luther King? So may we all take the best of his example and let that inspire us as we go forth in our practice and our lives. And I hope that this has been helpful talk. If any of it has not been helpful, leave it here. And also try to have fun with your fear. See if you can enjoy it. Enjoy practicing with it, investigating it. Enough? Thank you very much.